Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to this Peak Prosperity Podcast. It's January 26th, 2017, and I am your host, Chris Martinson. Now, as I'm recording this, the U.S. stock markets are excitedly hitting new all-time highs. The Dow has just cracked the 20,000 mark, and the world's equity markets are powering to new 17-month highs, looking at all-time highs as well. The narrative is that this has something to do with Trump, although I cannot find anybody who can explain to me why Europe's markets should be anything but threatened by the trade stances of Trump. Regardless, that's the narrative being used to explain all these seemingly unstoppable stock market advances. However, as you already well know, the explanations put forth in the media to explain things are nearly always inaccurate, just plain misleading sometimes, or just wrong. My own favorite theory is that the stock markets are no longer divination machines capable of discounting the future, but merely liquidity gauges telling us that the world's central banks have overdone it again and poured too much fuel into the furnace. Now, to really understand the probable future, you have to be rooted in the fundamentals. Always, always, always. And I know that fundamentals are out of favor right now, but trust me, they will come roaring back. They always do. Today, I'm very excited to have with us one of the world's great economists. Yes, some do exist. And a master of the fundamentals, Harry Dent. Harry is the author of The Sale of a Lifetime and editor of the free newsletter Economy and Markets, which can be found at harrydent.com. Mr. Dent has correctly called nearly every major economic trend over the past 30 years, including the 1991 recession, Japan's lost decade, the 2001 tech crash, the bull market and housing boom of the last decade, and most recently, the credit and housing bubble. Now, he is saying that U.S. equities are going to, quote, crash to a degree we haven't seen since the Great Depression, end quote. He has recently predicted a drop in the Dow to 6,000 and, quote, when the dust settles, it'll eventually plummet to 3,300. Along the way, we'll see another real estate collapse. Gold will sink to $750 an ounce and unemployment will skyrocket. It's going to get ugly, end quote. Certainly provocative views that I know we are all excited to explore with Mr. Dent. Harry, welcome to the program.
Well, nice to be here, Chris.
Well, thanks. Now, Harry, before we dive into current events and your predictions, I would love for you to tell our listeners about your methodology so they understand the basis for your views and predictions. What's your framework?
Well, you know, first, what I do, Chris, is I don't study government policies because governments react to what the real economy does. And the real economy, 80% of it, to be exact, is driven by consumers and businesses, and that's mostly consumer spending. So I look at the predictable things people do as they age, and I look at things that impact consumer spending and business growth. Everything from the aging of the population and people get, you know, spend more money in their mid to late 40s to get more productive as workers. I look at technology cycles and when technologies come together most favorably for business and productivity of workers. And these things are crystal clear and they're very easy to forecast. So what I tell people against what economists say, the long term is easy to forecast and see. It's the short term that can be incredibly difficult because more and more cycles come in as you get more short term, more and more political factors. I mean, just imagine how hard it would have been, and even the smartest money I track didn't get this one, to predict that Donald Trump, number one, would win against clear polls that said Hillary had it in the bag, 80% chance of winning, and then if he did win by surprise, would go against all the pundits saying, oh my gosh, he's going to create so much uncertainty that the markets are going to crash or go down. The opposite happened. That's how difficult the short term can be to predict. But the long term, yes, I could see that Japan's baby boom generation was peaking decades ahead of the rest of the world because it was born primarily at peak just before and after World War II. And Japan was going to crash in the 90s when the rest of the world's baby boomers were in their strongest spending stages. And the United States and Europe and other countries. And you know, we could see that housing was going to peak ahead of the economy, because housing spending peaks ahead of peak spending. And so I the most important indicators I have, I got in the 80s. The first one was the spending wave. It's simply a 46-year lag on the birth index, which I adjust for immigrants, legal and illegal, that are here today and when they were born on average. And 46 is when the average family spends the most money in their life. And we get yearly updates from the government and the Consumer Expenditure Survey on not only total spending and by age, but from cradle to nursing homes. You know, I can tell you when potato chips peak, that's age 42. Hmm. When cruise ship travel peaks, that's age 70. Nursing homes are going to be the hottest thing for the next three decades we've ever seen, because the baby boomers are just about to start entering that last thing that peaks at age 84, and largely for women. So we look at demographics, but I also look at geopolitical cycles. And by the way, the demographics, which we predicted way back in the late 80s when Japan was declining, when we were predicting that, we said, hey, the U.S. baby boom's not going to peak until 2007, and then our economy will weaken, as it did on that 46-year lag in 2008. We've been living off of QE ever since. But there was a cycle that I had to kind of come up with, because the second boom and bubble from 2002 to 2007, which we predicted, but I thought it would be much stronger, like the first bubble from 95 to 2000. I had to go back and dig and found out why, and I found a geopolitical cycle that's positive every 17 to 18 years, you know, kumbaya in the world, and then it's negative. Well, that cycle hit in 2001 for obvious reasons, 9/11, and has been terrible ever since. That cycle doesn't bottom until around 2020, and then things get more favorable again. I've also tracked a technology cycle. You just look back. I mean, this is one of the most clock-like. Every 45 years, you know, the steam engine came and then peaked in its impact in factories, and then steamships peaked in 1875, and then railroads peaked in 1920, and automobiles saturation and superhighways in 1965, and now recently the internet. We've all got the internet. We've all got Google, email, broadband, and all these things, and smartphones and stuff. And now innovation's down to social media. And to me, Facebook is great, but it's entertainment. It's dancing cats and dogs. It's not not going to triple the productivity of my research business like Google and email did. And then finally, there's a roughly 10-year boom-bust cycle, which I have a secret way of forecasting, which nobody's aware of. Here's the point, Chris. All four of these cycles point down now. One after the next has peaked in the last several years. All four point down into early 2020 or so. That's only happened in the early to mid 70s when we had the worst stock crashes back then, and OPEC and, you know, cartels and all this stuff, the worst crisis since the 1930s. And of course, in the early 30s, we had this same configuration of all four of these fundamental cycles that has taken me 30 years to hone and say, these are the four that matter. Another problem with economists, Chris, is very simple. They look at so many indicators and short-term stuff that they can't see the forest for the trees. That's why they miss these long-term trends that are so predictable. So the next 3 years is likely to be very, very likely to be the worst we see in our lifetimes. It will be more like the early 1930s. And when stocks hit this sort of debt bubble and financial asset bubbles crashes, which they only do once in a lifetime, like the early 1930s, stocks are going to be down 70, 80, 90%. That should be expected in this stage of the cycle after such a bubble. So I've gone from being the most bullish economist in the 80s and 90s to now one of the most bearish, because what goes up goes down, and that's what cycles do. And at heart, I'm a cycle guy, and demographics just happens to be the most important cycle in this modern era since, and only since, we've had a middle class form. And that only really since World War II has the everyday person mattered so much, because they have 50, 60,000 incomes and can buy homes over 30 years and borrow a lot of money. This was not the case before the Great Depression and World War II. So that's a brief summary of my fundamentals and why I am telling people this is not the time to believe in this Trump rally. And I'll go into that. I'll show you why that cannot last and he cannot create 4% growth. And people should be getting real safe, especially for the next 3 years. Now, after that, and the point of this book, new book, The Sale of a Lifetime, there's going to be one opportunity after next to buy stocks or emerging market stocks or commodities or gold or real estate. And then we also go into which areas are going to be favored by demographics and our cycles. But there's going to be, you're never going to see prices this low if you protect your capital now and convert it to cash or safe long-term high-quality bonds, then you are going to be able to take advantage of the sale of a lifetime. If you don't, you're going to see your financial assets wiped out a good bit more than they were in 2008 and 9, and the markets aren't going to come roaring back to new highs next time.
Now, Harry, a lot of provocative and very interesting information in there. Let me start here with this then, because I think we can build off this nicely. A very open question for myself, my listeners all over the world as well, obviously, is this going to be inflation or is this deflation? You're talking deflation. That's what I'm hearing in a fall in these financial asset prices. So when I have somebody like John Hussman on or Grant Williams or other astute Fed observers, Axel Merck, people like that who know the Fed, the central banks well, they say they've committed some of the most egregious policy blunders ever because they've tried to do things like prevent the very cycles you're talking about, at least the business cycle and asset cycles. They want to see if they can smooth those out, prevent them from going bust, all of that. And at this point, when we try and resolve the inflation versus deflation question, there are some who say that when this next sort of deflationary wave comes, the central banks, well, they know what to do. They're just going to keep printing. You're saying they're going to lose that battle. Do I have that right?
Yes, and I'll tell you why. They've already printed $13 trillion globally, and of course Japan and Europe are still going at rapid rates, especially Japan. And guess what we've gotten out of that? 0 to 1 to 2% at best inflation in all the developed countries that are printing all this money. It's because this money is being printed to stop and tame deflation, because deflation means debt is deleveraging, banks are failing, businesses are failing, prices are going down. That squeezes margins. That's what happened in the Great Depression. Deflation is a wrecking ball. Now, the biggest problem here, as you're saying, these other experts were correctly saying, this is terrible policy to try to smooth out these cycles in the economy. The economy grows through the dynamics of opposite. Free market capitalism is the opposite of democracy, just like men and women are opposites and you know, positive and negative poles on a battery. That's how you create energy and dynamic growth. Inflation and deflation are part of this cycle. Booms and busts are part of these cycles. In the bust, and in inflationary and deflationary times, is when we get the greatest innovations that then move mainstream with the next demographic boom. So this dynamic is necessary. And by stopping this dynamic and just creating a coma economy where Japan's been growing 0% now for 26 years, and the U.S. has been growing at 2% now for 8 years, and that's not going to even last with demographics getting worse. You just basically freeze innovation. You kill the golden goose, I call it. So this is terrible policy, but also they are fighting such persistent long-term downward demographic and even technological innovation trends and all this sort of stuff. I mean, here's what happens in an economy for the first time in history where you have the baby boom generation in most developed countries larger than the millennial generation following them. As we move forward, you get to the point where there's more baby boomers retiring than millennials entering the workforce. Oh, the workforce is not growing, which it's not. It's negative for the next several years. Then it's just above barely positive for decades to come. How do you grow 4% with that? Productivity has been going down ever since the baby boomers started retiring in the very late 1990s. And it's gone from 67% to now 62.5%. And by the time they fully retire by 2024, it's going to be 58% by our projection. We're going to lose another 4.5 million of our workforce. How do you grow at 4% with a declining workforce for decades to come? How do you grow at near zero productivity? We're at the lowest productivity rates since the Bob Hope generation was retiring in mass in the early 80s, the down of their cycle, and it's going to get worse. So this Trump thing of he's going to like just shift around the pie and shift taxes from the government to the consumer and businesses, you know, and cut off some regulations and things like that and build some infrastructure. This is not going to happen. You are not going to create 4% growth. It's demographically impossible. Japan has been stimulating much longer than us at 3 times the rate of quantitative easing in the last several years, and they're still long-term growing zero, with zero inflation and zero productivity, and they would have had deflation and bank failures if they had not printed so much money. So the money being printed is to keep the banks from falling over like the Great Depression. But the price of that, you go into a coma economy like Japan, you never go from what I call the winter deleveraging deflationary season back to the next spring mild inflation boom as we did going from the 30s to the 40s, 50s, and 60s. So this is horrible policy. If we'd have let this crisis happen and let some banks fail and some companies fail and gone to this, we'd be over the worst by now. The Great Depression, the worst of it was over in 3 years, and then we did nothing but grow for decades after that because we lifted a lot of debt off of consumers and businesses. When banks fail, it's because they have bad loans. They have to write them down or write them off, and then that's why they go under, and then the stronger banks take over their assets, and you reorganize the banking system, but you come out of it with far less debt. Japan now has more debt than ever. We have more debt than ever, and our deficit, our government deficit, which is the smallest part of our debt, private debt's much larger, is doubling every 8 years. Has anybody noticed this? 5 to 10 trillion under Bush, 10 to 20 under Obama. It's going to be 20 to 40 over the next two administrations, and I don't think it's going to be Donald Trump. I said when he got elected, I would not be surprised if he doesn't last the first year either because he does something so stupid that he kind of gets pushed out or impeached, or he gets shot. If anybody's going to get shot, people who shake up things, and he's shaking up things more than anybody in history at the most rapid rate, people who shake up things like Reagan, like Kennedy, like Lincoln, often get shot.
Well, now there's this is, we can feel the pressures building, right? So you said we got nothing for all of our QE. It's not quite right. We got the world's—
We got 2% growth we wouldn't have had, and when we did stop. A banking system collapse like the 30s. 2008 looked just like 1930. No, I get Republicans say that all the time to me, Chris. You know, oh, Harry, this quantitative easing did nothing. Oh, no, it did a lot. The problem is there's a big price for it. It kills the whole free market system and kills free markets in general. The central banks have taken over the bond markets and pushed down long-term risk-free rates, and everything else, real estate, bonds, stocks are heavily impacted by these sub-zero rates.
Well, not just impacted, but I'll give you the other thing that I was heading towards is that it also gave us the largest wealth gap in all of history. You know, last year, 62 people had as much wealth as half the world. This year, that number is 8, right? This breeds a sort of social injustice. Listen, we're primates, we're humans. Like, we hate unfairness. This is deeply unfair that the central banks are printing out of thin air, and it's really preferentially showing up in a very small set of pocketbooks. That's not really good for the social experiment. So we have a lot of tensions around all of this, but let's talk about what it hasn't done. It hasn't led to a real resurgence in corporate R&D and the next wave of investments that are going to do great things for growth or a future economy or productivity. We've got, you know, financial engineering, we've got speculation, we've got prop trading. Listen, Rome went down this path. You debase your currency, you just print it out of thin air, or make your coins lesser and lesser actual metal content. And people catch on. We're smart. We go, hey, if that's the game, I'll do this. Why would I expend effort trying to create real new value products and services? It's risky and it's hard work. I'll just go over here into this highly speculative arena pool, knowing that the central bank has got my back. They're going to bail me out if I really screw up here and make bad decisions.
That's right.
That's just awful.
Why not just flip homes and speculate in tech stocks?
Yeah, why not?
Exactly. It's a something economy. It's artificial. It's growing for the wrong reasons. And all it has created, and people keep saying, oh, well, the Fed's going to hit massive inflation at some point. No, they're not. The problem with the Fed's policies, what's going to kill them and defeat this, is all they've done is create even greater bubbles in debt and in financial assets, real estate and stocks and everything, than we had in 2007, and they're going to burst again. Bubbles only burst, and they don't even need something big to happen. Real estate started going down before the economy went down, before the subprime crisis got nasty, because it got too expensive, and baby boomers were running out of their home buying cycle. So bubbles always burst. And so that's the danger here. What's going to trigger this next bubble? I mean, a banking crisis is already brewing big time, worse than Greece, in Southern Europe and Italy. Germany has worse demographics than the Japanese had going in the 1990s in the decade ahead. And everybody thinks Germany's going to be the strongest country in Europe that holds it together. And Deutsche Bank is going down, you know, like a flaming plane already. China's got bubbles in real estate that are so extreme, they're going to have to burst in the next few years. And when that happens, you're going to trigger a tsunami around the world and real estate crashes. So this thing is not going to last much longer, and these bubbles are going to burst. And that's the price we're going to pay for this free money, something for nothing economy, where, like you say, people get rich, the rich get extremely richer. This does favor, and it's not the top 1% I look at, it's the top 0.1% mm-hmm. that have run away. They have as much wealth as the rest of the 1% put together. These are the people making the most money off of free money, because they can leverage and they have the money to invest in these financial assets. And they're the ones that benefit, while Homer Simpson has very little in the markets and only their home. And of course, that home got killed in the last Great Recession, and it'll get killed worse again. So you're right. This is income inequality off the charts. It's exactly what the economy looked like in 1929 before the Great Depression, not just the peak of a generation spending, not just a debt bubble, not just financial asset bubbles, but we had the same 1% of people controlling 50% of the wealth, just like we have now, and it's getting even worse. So yeah, this is not sustainable, period. And when it crashes, it's going to be worse than ever. I mean, all they've done is create a bigger bubble. We've added $57 trillion more debt around the world, you know, to the $150 trillion we had at the top of the last bubble, and most of this in the emerging world, which is the least stable and is getting crushed by crashing commodity prices. I mean, we got the worst downturn. I'm convinced next 3 years, worst financial crisis and bubble burst of our lifetimes, and we will not see something this bad again. So, hey, stocks are way overvalued. You got this very irrational Trump rally, which I call the final blow-off phase. I don't think it lasts past July, but I do think it goes higher. I think we're going to see stocks at least 10% higher from here before the economy figures out that we can't grow at 4% no matter what this crazy person does. And he is a crazy person. He may be smart in a lot of ways, but he is crazy. Any psychologist would mark him off on a few things right away. So when it bursts, people are going to be surprised. And one of the things I warn people most, Chris, yeah, people say, well, gosh, I don't want to get out of this bubble. Yeah, maybe it's a bubble, but it keeps going up. Here's the problem with bubbles. They're going to go down typically 80%, 70 to 90%. And especially in stocks and commodities. But half of that crash and most of the bubbles in history has come in the first 2 to 3 months when the markets finally get it and the smart money runs like crazy and the dumb money and most people are ending up holding stocks that go down 40 to 45% in 2 to 3 months. This happened in the 29 crash. It happened in the Nikkei crash in 1990. It happened in the tech wreck in early 2000, and it happened just last year. You can see this just last year, China's second stock bubble burst 45% in the first 3 months in late 2015, and you had everyday households lost everything. They were getting money on margin and stuff. The government encouraged this stupidly to try to offset their real estate slowdown, and then people just got wiped out. So that's the danger. If you hold out, right now, I think this Trump rally has enough behind it that people are probably okay into the summer. But I tell you, if we see this market keep going up into the summer, and we start approaching that classic crash season from late July to late October, I'm going to tell people, you got to get out. You just got to be safe. And if you miss another 5%, then, hey, you could have gotten slammed, you know, 40% in 3 months. So better to do that.
Now, at the heart of all of this, of course, so you've got these big trends. You named these four big trends, and they have a very good both explanatory and predictive power. And it makes sense, right? We can say, well, what is an economy? It's people buying and consuming stuff. So maybe we should track the people. I get it. Now, what you talked about, though, is with the debt, the federal debt in the United States doubling every 8 years, using my handy dandy rule of 72, that's a 9% compounded annual rate of growth. So yeah. 9% are
versus GDP.
Exactly.
It's been growing anywhere between 2% recently and 3.5% at bet. I mean, and that's one statistic we quote from 1983 to 2008 in the baby boom, debt grew at 2.6 times the rate of GDP. Any economist that does not see that turning into a debt crisis down the road should not be an economist and should be barred from practicing. Most economists say, oh, this is okay. It's not okay.
Well, it's not. And so, the canard I have to bat around all the time is somebody say, well, so let's use Japan. It's the ultimate petri dish for this. Why that country hasn't gone down in flames right now, I don't understand, because the total amount of debt that they're carrying right now per household is about $1 million per household, right? It's just off the charts. And that's I'm looking at the total debt of the country, and people say, oh, but Chris, they owe it to themselves. What do you say to that one, Harry?
Well, first of all, the greatest amount of debt in our economy, all economies, developed world, is private debt, three times typically government debt, as much as four times in the boom. And that is owed to banks and people like that, and they go under. Or you go under when you can't pay it, or you lose your house, or you buy stocks on margin and you lose everything. So it's not true. And governments owe to themselves, okay, but a lot of this debt is supposed to be used, or government finance is supposed to be used to pay us Social Security and health care, which is underfunded by, get this, about $70 trillion, just like a lot of pension fund plans have to report the amount of pensions or health care benefits they promise their workers that has not been funded in an investment, in a conservative investment plan to meet those. The government's $70 trillion unfunded. So they get in a debt crisis, or they can't grow their debt further because nobody wants to buy their bonds anymore because their debt ratios are high. How are they going to pay our benefits? Well, they're not going to be able to pay them despite the debt crisis, but that only makes it worse. So it's absurd to say, oh, we owe it to ourselves. Studies show that when government debt gets above 90 to 100%, it starts to slow GDP growth. It's a burden on the economy. It's the same thing when household debt, gets 100%. Or more of GDP, it slows their spending because they're paying more and more interest, and the government's paying more and more interest. And right now, is we talked about earlier, by suppressing, artificially pushing their bond rates down to zero short term and more like 2% long term instead of typically 5 to 6% with the inflation rates we've had, they're cheating. They're able to handle this debt burden short term because they buy their own bonds and push rates down. Well, that's cheating, and that's not going to last. And in the long term, we're going to go back to, treasury bonds being more like 5 to 6%. And then the Japan would be bankrupt overnight. Their entire budget would be interest if we just went back to normal, 3% inflation and 5 to 6% long term bond rates. They'd be bankrupt overnight, and we would have interest would start to consume a huge portion of our government budget. So no, this is not sustainable, and it's just another ridiculous bubble talk. When you get in bubbles, I'll tell you why. People are stupid. That's what this book's about, Chris. People never see bubbles because they don't want to. They're in denial. They're getting something for nothing. Their house is going up at 15% a year instead of the normal 3% a year with inflation. Stocks are going up at 20% or higher a year instead of the normal 7% or something like that. And And their mortgage is costing them 4% instead of 6 to 7%. And their car, my car loans or leases are at 2% now. They used to be at 6%. We're getting a free lunch. People love that. It makes them feel good, makes them feel high. And when somebody like me says, hey, sorry, folks, we're in a debt bubble, we're in a financial asset bubble, and every one of these that looks like this in history has busted, and it has busted horribly when it has, and people have gotten wiped out, people want to shoot me. They want to shoot the messenger. They don't want to hear it. CNBC hates me. Some people in Fox Business like me because they see, they understand that debt is not good like this, but most people just don't want to hear it.
Now, you know, let's section the people out a little bit. There was this really interesting article just came out in the most recent issue of The New Yorker, where the very wealthy, including tech moguls who've really made it, like the startup co-founder of Reddit, but as well as many hedge fund managers, private equity people, they're very wealthy people. They've obviously got access to some very good information, and they're buying bunkers in New Zealand. Here's the thing I run into, Harry, is that the retail level, like the average person on the street, very hard to communicate some of this stuff to, definitely shooting the messenger and people who really don't want to believe otherwise. But the people who are the most worried right now are the people who have the most experience in the financial markets. I mean, you know, I talk with guys and gals with decades of experience, you know, running hedge funds for 30 years, and they look at all of this and they say, this is a mess. And it worries them because they're worried that when this next turn comes, it's not going to be like your grandpa's turn where humans in little red, orange, and blue coats start trading pieces of paper and things get a little out of hand. These are computers making decisions at light speed, operating in microseconds, saying we're out of this market potentially. So they're worried about these flash crashes that we see in small markets really somehow perpetuating across the larger market structure. That is, I think we've had an SEC asleep at the wheel. Sal Arnook and the other guys at Themis Training, that these are broken markets in many respects because we don't really have the same governing structures on them that we used to. It's a little bit worrisome, and maybe you've seen this as well. You know, when you see something like the dollar or the pound or U.S. Treasuries move by whole percentage points in a matter of minutes, you know, 6, 7, 8, 9 sigma moves, shouldn't happen once every 10 million to a billion year kind of stuff. It just speaks to me that this is a reason to be edgy, and the edgiest people I know are the ones who are the most sophisticated in these markets, and I don't know that most people have really connected those dots yet.
Yeah, that's what I call the smart money, and that's what I track. I look at the commitment of traders. You know, a small percentage of traders who are the commercial hedgers always tend to be on the right side of the market. At a major top, they're hedged bearish, and a major bottom, they're hedged bullish. And that's the people, and these people are the people who understand this and are saying, oh my God, this thing's got to go down. They're the people who understand the higher a market goes, the more vulnerable it is. For most investors, the longer they see real estate or stocks go up, the more confident they get that they won't fall. And that's a total misunderstanding of history and investing. So you're right. Only a small percentage of people get this. And it's the same people I talk to. I'm just not going to be a mainstream forecaster at this point, because everybody's hoping this works out. And everybody, as much as people know, Trump's got the impulse control of a grease fire and he's kind of a crazy person. They're like, well, but we hope he does some stuff and takes us back to 4%. They're hoping. Anybody that looks at the fundamentals, anybody that looks at cycles, debt cycles, financial asset cycles, anybody that looks at bubbles, this whole book has so many charts showing that all these bubbles look alike. They look like the male orgasm chart from Masters and Johnson's back in the late 50s. And that's exactly what they are. They're like a financial orgasm, and orgasms can only go so far till they get too intense. And then when they end rapidly. Mm-hmm. And that's what happens with bubbles. So I go out of my way to say, look, everybody, politicians are telling you this is not a bubble. Goldman Sachs is saying it's not a bubble. Economists are saying it's not a bubble. CNBC is saying it's not a bubble. Don't listen to these people. This looks like a bubble, quacks like a bubble, walks like a bubble. This is a bubble, and bubbles only do one thing. They don't have soft landings. They burst violently, and the typical stock bubble, as I said earlier, is 80%, and that's how much Japan's ultimately went down. In the Great Depression, it was 89% for the U.S. stock market. We were kind of like the China, the up-and-coming, most leveraged country back then. So China probably will be 90%. U.S., it'll probably be 80%. And that's not something you want to sit through, because after that bubble burst in the early 30s, stocks took 24 years to get back to those 1929 highs. You'll be dead as a retiree if you wait for if you listen to your stockbroker and say, well, he'll say stocks go, you know, always come back, and we have you diversified. I also ask investors to look at your new 2008 crash portfolio. How did diversification work for you there? When real estate went down, commodities went down, gold and silver included, every stock market in the world, emerging markets, developed markets, small caps, large caps, all went down. How did that diversification work for you? It didn't.
Well, now, Harry, I got to get to the heart of this then. So I'm going to assume that that the safest investment here, in your view, is cash. And I'm guessing not Japanese yen either, but U.S. dollars. Is that fair?
Yeah, cash in U.S. dollars, because the U.S. dollar versus other currencies was the only one that really rallied in when 2008 meltdown happened. It went up 27% in 3 or 4 months, not because we have good monetary policies. We're the best house in a bad neighborhood demographically, and we have less quantitative easing cumulative than Europe and way, way less than Japan. So the U.S. and dollars, but also the highest quality bonds in the Great Depression for that entire decade, where stocks and real estate and commodities and everything else got decimated, the long-term treasury bonds and AAA corporate bonds, the highest quality long-term bonds, roughly doubled in value when you include their dividends. And they paid higher dividends, or they're now with a bounce in yields, are paying as higher dividends in stocks. And I think these yields could bounce a little farther later this year. So yeah, it's the safest assets, highest quality bonds. You can bet on the U.S. dollar going up, at least in the early stage of the crisis. UUPs, an ETF that tracks that. The U.S. dollar is at 100. It's 45% higher than when the Great Recession started in January 2008, and it bottomed. And I think it's going to at least 120. So U.S. dollar or U.S. dollar index or dollar bullish funds, highest quality U.S. government and AAA corporate bonds, and just good old cash. Nothing wrong with having liquid cash that every time assets go down, you can buy more of them, and you've got the cash to do it, because don't think anybody's going to lend you money to buy stocks or real estate at the bottom of this next crisis. So you got to have cash or high quality stuff, and you can sell those bonds any day. And guess, and these bonds not only could get 3 to 3.5% yields on something safe, they appreciate when deflation brings those yields back down. The bonds appreciated from 1931 to 1941, a 10-year bull market after stocks and everything crashed. So the bonds are the one bubble that are getting a setback now, but the one bubble that'll be the last to burst many years from now.
I agree with that. Now, this brings me to my final question, which is really about gold. And I'm not, gold and silver are two separate words to me. I don't lump them together. Gold's a monetary asset to me, and it's primarily why I like it. And so here's the question. As we get into this deflationary aspect, which I agree with you, feels like the end stage to all of this, I no longer trust the statements of any of the major commercial banks. I think there's going to be an enormous banking crisis with that. So when you say cash, if that means cash in the bank, I think we have to understand which bank matters, because not all are created equal. Some of them are carrying derivatives that nobody can understand at this point. And gold to me is potentially a means of having a monetary asset outside of a system that, frankly, I've lost a lot of faith in, if not all of my trust, especially with the bail-in provisions and the sneaky war on cash stuff, courtesy of Summers and Rogoff and all those other cast of slimy characters and whatnot. But it feels to me like people are being herded into a banking system that is just like the last corral you ever want to get caught in, right? Potentially. So when you say cash, what do you mean by that? And second, how does gold fit into that story?
Okay, first of all, very good question. You have to have your cash or your safe bonds or your dollar index or whatever in a brokerage account whether it be in a bank or a brokerage firm. I like to be with online brokerage firms because they're not banks that also lend money against real estate and can get crippled and stuff. But if you have it in the bank, in a checking account or savings account, they do lend that money out into these bubbles, especially into real estate. And when they lose that money, your money will not be there as it wasn't in the early 30s. So if you're in a brokerage account, they can't lend against that, even if it's in a bank. I'd rather have it. I have my money, you know, with Schwab or somebody like Scottrade, because they're not in the business of lending or investment banking and all this sort of stuff. So that's first thing. Second thing, gold. Gold correlates with one thing long term and one thing only, and that's inflation. And also short term. Gold is an inflation hedge. That's why it was such a great investment in what I call the summer season of high inflation and recession or stagflation. That's a part of my 80-year cycle that works like a clock. But it's not a deflation hedge. Gold, people don't get, gold was a bigger bubble than the stock market. Gold went up 8 times in 10 years between 2001 and 2011. We told people to get out of silver and gold when silver retested its 1980 bubble high, previous bubble high. We said this looked like a good time to get out. Gold went a little higher into September. But basically, we told people, get out. This is a bubble. Bubbles have to burst. And these things follow the commodity cycle, which is a 30-year clock. Gold did not provide that safe haven. I look back in late 2008. When things really melted down and it looked like we were going in a Great Depression and major banks were failing and General Motors could have gone under and AIG and all this sort of stuff, gold went down 33%. Silver went down 50%. They did not protect you. So I don't trust gold. For gold to erase its bubble, and I look in this book, The Principles of Bubbles, is they build up exponentially. When they burst in half the time typically it took them to build, and they go back to where the bubble started. Not the whole bull market, whatever that is, when they started to diverge from the fundamental trends and go up more exponentially. Gold has to go down to $400 to erase that bubble, and it could possibly, at worst, retest those 2001 lows around 250. I'm looking for gold to hit 700, give or take, in the next year or so, and I'm not going to be interested in gold till it gets at least to 400, and then I would love it, because the next commodity cycle is going to be driven by emerging countries who are huge consumers of gold and silver, huge consumers of commodities as a percentage of their income, and the biggest producers and exporters of commodities. So I think the next commodity cycle is going to be a doozy, but commodities have already crashed and won't turn around until at least 2020. And then if gold's at $400, then I say, you know what, I'd buy this and think it could go to 4,000 over the next commodity cycle. And that next commodity cycle wouldn't peak until about 2038 to 2040. So I do not like gold. It's not the safe haven in a deflationary environment. It is the safe haven in an inflationary environment. And of course, once this endless quantitative easing breaks down and all these bubbles burst, I mean, and again, real quick to summarize here, the reason you get deflation in this winter season is that when debt deleverages, money disappears. Loans are written off, that money disappears. When bubbles burst, like the Dow goes from 22,000 down to 4,000, 80% of people's wealth disappears and doesn't come back for a long time. That creates less money chasing the same goods and financial assets and everything else, and that creates deflation in prices, not inflation.
And certainly very much non-mainstream views. And we have been talking with Harry Dent, author of the new book, The Sale of a Lifetime. It's chock full of just fascinating thinking. And of course, somebody you should be listening to, and editor of the free newsletter, Economy and Markets, found at harrydent.com. Harry, anything else you need to tell people about events or how they can follow you more closely?
No, I think the best thing, get on our free newsletter, because that's the way you can get to know us. I mean, I think we got... you know, limited months, maybe 6 months left in this market. I want by the middle of this year, you to be convinced to make some very hard decisions, because everybody else, including your stockbroker and your best friend, are going to and the media and everybody's going to tell you otherwise. You need to make some hard decisions, and you're not going to do that unless you're convinced. So yes, get the book and get on our free newsletter. We also have paid newsletters if you want to get more depth, but you need to be convinced. So get serious about this, and hey, if this doesn't happen in the next couple years, then I'm going to quit my profession and be a limo driver at the Gold Coast in Australia.
All right. Well, you'll be fighting for fares with me at that point in time. So, Harry, thank you so much for your time today. Let's do this again sometime soon.
Okay. Thank you, Chris.